Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our daily coverage of the 2019 Iditarod here on Mushing Radio. You can hear us in the Matsu Valley on RadioFreePalmer.org and 89.7 on the old school radio dial. And just a quick note before we jump into our show today. As they say, the show must go on. I'm currently calling on my speakerphone of my iPhone, sitting in the parking lot of Starbucks, and cannot connect to Wi-Fi. So if I sound a little muted or whatever, that is the reason. But even up here in Alaska, we cannot connect to Wi-Fi like everybody takes advantage of just about everywhere else in the world. So joining us today from Southern California is our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. And, you know, we have had a very interesting and dramatic last 24 hours in Iditarod. For people who were looking at the standings and looking at what was happening late last night, it looked like Nick Petit was in the process of running away with the race. He had been racing for ever since the start as if he had something to prove. He took a bit of a wrong turn last year and felt like he should have won the race but didn't. So he's really been trying to pour on the speed a lot. And last night he went out of Unalakleet, went through Shaktulik, was blowing through the sea ice, and then all of a sudden he just stopped. And he was going around 7 or 8 miles per hour, then slowed down to about 1 mile per hour, and then suddenly was sitting there on the sea ice. And he remained there for many, many hours, finally moved a couple of miles further to a little outcropping of land. I don't know if you call it an isthmus or something like that, where there's a shelter cabin. So he was off the ice and in the shelter cabin, but this was around, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 or 11 o'clock last night, Alaska time, and he is still on that island. So he has gone from being in first place and being someone who looked like he was well on the way to winning the race to now being in 11th. And that is really, really dramatic. And, you know, we talk a lot about the importance of run-rest cycles. And I have to say that when I was first learning about Iditarod and first started following Iditarod, I would frequently look at the standings and look at the leaderboards and think to myself, why is this musher or that musher spending so much time in the checkpoint and so much time resting? If they just pushed their dogs a little bit harder, if they just went a little bit more or a little bit faster, they could do much better. And although I'm not, you know, casting any aspersions or blaming anyone, and I realize that this is a little bit dangerous because certainly Nick Petit knows more about mushing than I will ever know probably in my life. But it really seems like what is happening there is that he may have overdriven his dogs or not given his dogs enough rest until they just kind of quit on him. And Sebastian Schnulli, who's a race official this year and has run Iditarod a bunch himself, said this morning that people had gone out and checked on Nick and Nick was fine and the dogs were fine. Later this afternoon, we started a few more details about what's going on, started dribbling in. And Nick said that that several of his dogs started fighting and he yelled at them to try to get them to settle down. And they're not used to being yelled at. So the dogs just up and stopped. And even after he separated the fighting dogs, they just didn't want to go. And now we're looking at about 18 hours later, and they are still basically sitting in that same spot. A bunch of teams have passed him. He had hoped that when the other teams passed and his dog saw the dogs running, it would get them excited about running again. But I think this is just a really good illustration of the old adage that if your dogs don't want to run, they're not going to run. And there is almost nothing you can do if your dogs have decided they don't want to run.
Right. I totally agree with you there. And again, we don't have all the details from the trail and what exactly Nick is thinking about, but just sort of speculating, as we talked a little bit about last night with deciding to scratch or not. And I told the story about being in the middle of the swamp in the middle of the day, and my dogs pretty much just said, you know what, guy, we're done. We're not going to go any further. No matter what you do, we're going to sleep right here, and we're going to stay here until we're good and ready. And that's what sled dogs do. And remember, you're dealing with 14 individual personalities in terms of your dogs. And I'm sure everybody that's listening who has a pet dog or who has been around pet dogs or tried to train a dog, they can be very stubborn if they want to be. And this is exactly what happens on a sled dog trail as well. And for folks that are listening, if you had not had the chance to head over to Emily Maxwell's Facebook page, she does a masterful job of telling this story about how her dogs and Marcel's dogs, Marcel Frisano's dogs, quit there about 6 miles or so from Iditarod. And of course, Emily ended up having to press her SOS button and get towed into the checkpoint and so on and so forth. So I don't know if exactly the same thing is happening with Nick's team, but I think that is going to be a great analogy or comparison about what happens when dogs do quit on the trail. Alex, did you get a chance to hear to read that description on Facebook?
No, I didn't. I was just clicking over to it as you were talking and trying to find it. But it's like we said yesterday, because we live in a social media world, a lot of times when teams scratch, the musher will post an explanation of it, but it doesn't always happen. And it sounds like the description that she gave from what you said is something that is very, very helpful and very informative.
Right. And right before we went on air, I was reading some of the articles on the local newspapers and whatnot, and people were asking about how long can Nick wait there at that cabin. Well, first and foremost, I'm sure his dogs are very well sheltered and taken care of, at least to this point, and Nick is inside, and there's not a heck of a lot of concern in regards to where he's at. But there is some concern sort of going around, in particular with the mushers who aren't racing, obviously, about how much longer he can stay there with his food supplies, and will passing mushers offer him sort of a helping hand? Will they give him some food to feed his dogs and so forth? And we've talked a lot about it this season, about sort of that giving nature of Iditarod mushers and sort of the mushing community in general. And I'm sure that that's going to happen as teams are going on their way. But I can only imagine how devastating that this can be to Nick and his team. Because as you said, he was in the race for the running, for the winning. And he was onward towards Nome, and he was really doing a great job. And of course, dogs are going to be dogs, and they pretty much just said, this is it. And in the meantime, as we are working our way onward to Nome, I believe, and I haven't checked the standings since I got here, but Pete Kaiser pretty much just passed Nick, and he took control of the race. Who besides Pete Kaiser up there in the running onwards towards Nome?
So it's the three who were making up the sort of the chase pack that was right on Nick's heels. So it's Pete Kaiser, Yor Olsom, and Jesse Royer. And currently, Jesse is still in Koyuk. She was going a little bit slower than the other two, but Yor and Pete Kaiser are out of Koyuk and moving down the trail. So we've got Yore is, I think, about 7 or 8 miles out of Koyuk, and then Pete Kaiser is another 6 miles ahead of him leading the race, which is still very, very close. Jesse Royer was coming up on the ice, was not going nearly as fast, so she wound up being about an hour behind Pete coming into Koyuk. And then since then, we now have Jesse Holmes, Ali Zirkel, Mitch Seavey, Matt Hall, Travis Beals, Matt Thaler have since passed Nick. So they are all on their way up to Koyuk.
And I believe it was one of the commentators for the newspapers or TV stations that said that I believe it was Jake Berkowitz, and it could have been Danny Seavey. I'm not sure which, but they said that, and I agree with them, time is running out to make real impactful decisions in terms of, you know, somebody passing somebody or you know, really a big change in the leaderboard or anything like that. Because once you fall into that sort of that last few checkpoints, everything's pretty much shaken out unless they're really, really close. And you talked about Yore and Pete being about 6 miles apart. And if you're traveling at 6 or 7 miles an hour, which is a typical Iditarod pace, that's almost an hour ahead of him. So that's a pretty good distance in terms of time that he would have to make up. Now, if there's a longer rest or a problem on the trail or taking a wrong turn or whatever, those variables are possible, but just all in out making a mistake, I think that the leaderboard is kind of set. What do you think?
You know, I think what the last day has taught us is that there's still a long way to go before you get to Nome. And I was actually thinking when I went to sleep last night, well, that's it. Nick is going to win, and he can't be caught. And then, of course, as soon as I think that, the Iditarod gods, you know, frown upon me and say, "Oh yeah, well, we'll show you." So, you know, it's very much still a game where anything can happen. But as you said, the closer you get to Nome, the harder it is to make up that hour or those 2 hours. I think when you're still at Shaktulik or Unalakleet, 3 or 4 hours is something that could shift without too much difficulty. But when you start getting down towards White Mountain, 2 or 3 hours can be an enormous amount of time unless something goes drastically wrong. And we've seen in the past things going drastically wrong, like the year that Jeff King got caught in that windstorm and Ali Zirkel passed him, and then Dallas Seavey just came and went right through and won the race. So barring something like that happening, I think by the time we get a little bit further down the trail, it's going to be pretty well set.
Right. So let's jump on over to a couple of updates that we want to talk about. The first one that we want to mention is something that we were talking about on Twitter last night, and it revolves around the passionate mushers that are using the hashtag Ugly Dogs, and they're huge fans of not only Blair Braverman now, but sort of the entire mushing community. Everybody's rooting for everybody, and you know, just sort of taking the world by storm on social media. But they have something going on with a group of spreadsheets, and it's like nothing I've never seen before with a group of fans. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is going back to the Iditarod hashtag that we talked about. And initially what had happened is there were a group of kids in Nikolai who were raising money for a school trip to Anchorage. And some of the Ugly Dogs noticed this and said, well, we should fund this. And over the course of literally just, I think, 7 or 8 hours, a whole lot of them with relatively small donations, mostly in the $10 to $25 or $50 range, fully funded this field trip to go to Anchorage. And after that happened, a lot of people in the Ugly Dogs community said, well, maybe there are other things that we can look into funding. And so they started looking into supporting a bunch of different causes, especially school-related causes, and in Alaska and other places, and school-related causes dealing with schools that primarily cater to the Native community or to communities out in the bush. And we're talking literally, I think, the last 2 or 3 days, they have raised over $30,000 to fund a whole bunch of these projects. And it's often little things. It's stuff like buying replacement chairs to replace chairs that are run down or maybe have sharp, you know, sharp points that kids could get hurt sitting in, and all sorts of little things like that. So again, this is a very cool thing that Blair Braverman's fans have been doing, and really my hat is off to all of them, because it's a remarkable thing. And like you said, I've never seen anybody do something like this revolving around Iditarod before. So it's just an amazing thing.
It is. And going back to those spreadsheets, when we were talking on Twitter to some of these fans, they said that they have spreadsheets for all sorts of things. They have spreadsheets for mushrograms that we talked about. They have spreadsheets for sending out food to the call centers and to the trail. They have spreadsheets about where the teams are and where they're funding these projects. And you know, just all of these things that these fans are doing is giving so much positive light to Iditarod that I think is amazing. And to sort of piggyback on that, I believe it was Alaska Public Media wrote a story about this morning, and they talked about, I'm sorry, it was the Anchorage Daily News, about did Iditarod finally turn the corner and, you know, make up all of the kind of the bad press that they've gotten over the years. And they talked about, amongst other things, about, you know, more transparency with the board and listening to the mushers more and different changes in the rules and whatnot. And then at the very end of the article, they talked about this Blair Braverman windstorm that's really kicked up, and how they've just taken over social media, and how all of this positivity has changed the outlook of Iditarod. And I think, and I know we talked about this the other day, I think that this is going to do great things for our sport. I know that there's some difficulties out there that we still need to address in terms of kind of the negative press of Iditarod, but I think this is very much in a step in the right direction. I'm sure you agree.
Yeah, and I agree with all of that. And also, it's just a breath of fresh air, and it's like a jolt of energy. And it feels like it's been a while since Iditarod has had that kind of jolt of energy. So I think that's definitely a good thing.
So before we jump over to our musher profile, what other stories or updates would you like to share this evening?
Okay, so just very briefly, and this again is Ugly Dogs related. Blair has a friend of hers who came up to Alaska to help her run dogs and prepare for the Iditarod, named Yotam Haber, who is a musician and composer and pianist. And he came up, and apparently a couple of days ago, he was running some of her dogs who were obviously not taken with her on Iditarod. And his sled tipped over, and he was holding on to the sled, but he was trying, the dogs wanted to go and go and go, and he wanted to try to find something that would stop them. And the only thing that he could do was reach for the snow hook, and apparently one of his fingers got jammed in the snow hook and actually got severed. So he had one of his fingers that was that was kind of sliced off by this snow hook, which is a very sharp and very, very potentially dangerous, if used in the wrong way, instrument. And he was able to go back to the lodge where Blair and Q have been staying and have made their headquarters. The owners of the lodge were able to wrap the finger and get it, you know, sort of immobilized. They sent for a helicopter that was going to do a medevac thing, but the helicopter didn't come, so they wound up going on Snowcat and out to cars and so on, got him to a hospital in Fairbanks where a doctor was able to sew it back up, but said, you know, this is something that's going to be very complicated. You should probably fly home. So he went back to where he lives in New Orleans and had surgery, which was able to reattach the finger. And he had tweeted that he is fine and he thinks he's going to be okay and doesn't want anyone to be concerned about him, but instead to, you know, to send all of their energy and good thoughts to Blair when she's out on the trail, which is kind of an amazing thing, for a lot of reasons, but also, you know, when you're a musician, especially when you're a piano player, having all of your fingers that you can use is very important. So I am hopeful that he will, that the surgery was successful enough that he'll be able to regain the full use of that finger. But that's kind of a scary thing to even hear about.
It is. And as you were saying that, the first thing that was going through my mind when you said he was, you know, an expert piano player and there he lost a finger. My goodness is all I can say to that. And also what I would love to say to that is, as, from a musher's perspective, you can never take a single dog sled run for granted. The potential for so many things happening is enormous. Because you got to remember, and we talked about this a little bit just a little while ago, about having 12 or 14 different personalities. This is unlike any other sport out there. You know, if you're out there playing basketball, you may have, you know, three or four or five teammates that you're kind of worried about what's happening and they're sort of functioning as they're going. Or, you know, in football, you're concentrated on your position. But in dog mushing, you have 12, 14, 16, however many dogs you're running, individual pieces to the puzzle where everything has to work perfectly in order for you to have a successful run. And I cannot tell you, Alex, how many times I've been out on what I thought was just a routine run around the block, as I call it. And that is when I leave my outbound trail and I run around, you know, our trails behind our house 20 or 30 miles. And I tell my wife, Michelle, okay, I'm going out for a run now, a run around the block. I'll be back in a couple hours. And something doesn't go right. And whether, you know, one of my lines gets crossed or we have a tangle or we have a scuffle on the trail or there's open water or whatever, it's just an amazing experience every time I go out there. And it's something that you can never take for granted. And it's just such a testament, as you mentioned about this guy and just kind of going out on a run with the dogs that didn't make it, turned out to a major ordeal. I mean, he had to get transported by Snowcat, then he had to go to Fairbanks, and he had to have surgery up there, then fly all the way home to New Orleans, and all of that had to happen just from a routine run. And I know you know the experiences you can have on a relatively short run. We were only a mile or so from our house, and you fell off the sled, broke your shoulder, and you're still dealing with that today, aren't you?
Yeah, although, you know, I'm probably 85 or 90% healed from it, but it's still, you know, it's, and that was a freak accident, but it's still, as you said, anytime you go out, things can happen. And that's why, you know, that's why I think the people who are the really great mushers, they are prepared for so many eventualities. And, you know, you hopefully get to a point where you have done so much with the dogs, and you've done so much with mushing that you're able to react instinctively when things happen, because something always will happen.
Right. Any other updates before we jump over to the musher?
No, let's jump right over to our musher for the day. And I apologize in advance for mangling this name, which I am sure I'm going to do. But our musher of the day today is Martin Apoyuk Raitan. And he is 21 years old. He's a second generation Iditarod musher. He lives on the North Slope in Koktovik, where in the non-mushing season, he guides polar bear photography safari tours. His dad is Norwegian, and his mom is an Inupiaq native, grew up in Norway, and started mushing when he was only 4 years old. His family moved to Alaska, to Koktovik, in 2015. His dad is Cadel Raitan, who has finished the Iditarod seven times and run the Yukon Quest a whole bunch of times. He had a top 10 finish and ran last year, where he finished fourth from the slope. Martin is 21. He just finished about a month ago his first 1,000-mile race, where he was Rookie of the Year in the Yukon Quest. And that follows his brother, Vebjorn, who was the 2018 Yukon Quest Rookie of the Year. And after he finished the quest, Martin said that he feels really confident in the ability of his dogs. And his team for the Iditarod has eight dogs that he took with him on the quest, including his leader, Apoc. And then he has three dogs borrowed from Jesse Holmes, Ginny, Savage, and Pistol. Two dogs borrowed from Hugh Neff and Olivia Shankneff, which are Lebowski and Parker. And then at the last minute, he borrowed his 14th dog from Nick Petit, which is Callie. And he said that it's a very, very competent and strong team. He said on the quest that his major problem was with regulating his sleep patterns. And there was one checkpoint where he was taking a nap and the volunteers came to wake him up, and he didn't get up, and they had to wake him three times before he finally got up. And so he's hoping that on Iditarod, he's going to be able to adjust to that a little bit better, having already just done this huge quest. And the other cool thing about Martin is that after the race, when most mushers and their dogs would be making their way home, making their way back to Anchorage, he instead is going to take his dog team and mush them to Kotzebue, because his dad is going to be competing in the Kobuk 440, which starts shortly after Iditarod comes in. So he's a young musher, second generation, which is always really cool when there's a mushing family that is, that is continuing the tradition of mushing. And he is currently in Caltag, resting up in Caltag before he begins the portage over to Unalakleet. And he is in 38th place, traveling with a bunch of rookies who are all together, including Ryan Santiago, Nicholas Wakestrom, Sebastian dos Santos Borges. And so it's really encouraging and cool to me that there is someone who is a second generation Iditarod musher competing for the first time as a rookie.
What a cool story. And when you talked about him jumping right off of Iditarod and heading up to Kotzebue so his dad can run in the 440, the 440 takes place in the first weekend in April. And it's considered one of the tougher qualifiers up here in Alaska, because number one, it's 440 miles, but also it's spring mushing. So they're mushing up in an area where there are no trees, and you're pretty much just out there on the tundra. and it can be a very difficult race in terms of weather. But what I think so cool about that is back in the early days of the race, that's what they did. They made it to Nome, and then they pretty much just turned around and worked their way back. And back then, a lot of the teams were mushers from the villages, and they didn't have the infrastructure that they had today with, you know, loading all the dogs up on planes and delivering them back to Anchorage and all that sort of stuff. In the day, that's sort of how they did things. They turned around and camped on their way home. And I think that's such a cool story to hear about a team doing that in today's day and age, whether they're going home or they're literally going up the trail to do another race. So it looks like some of those dogs will be running in a heck of a lot of miles this year. You said that they ran in the Yukon Quest, which is 1,000. Then, of course, the Iditarod is 1,000, and then turning right around and doing it just a couple of weeks later in the Kobuk 440. That's a heck of a lot of racing miles, and that really shows just how hardy some of those dogs are on Martin's team. A quick update, Alex, that we did not mention in our story updates. It looks like we had another scratch this afternoon with Robert Reddington. Do you have any idea on that one? I know it's just your typical press release posting, but do you have any other information about Robert Reddington?
I don't. I'm actually just seeing that coming across now. Looks like he's scratched in Caltag. He only had 8 dogs, so it might have something to do with feeling like he didn't have enough dogs or didn't have the proper amount of leaders. I'm sure that we'll learn more about that as we go on. You know, just looking at the standings right now, there are a couple of teams that only have 7 dogs at the moment, and that's got to be tough when you are going down the trail, especially if you haven't yet gotten to the coast and you only have 7 dogs. You need to have 5 in harness when you finish, but generally speaking, it's rare for people to finish Iditarod with less than 8 or 9 dogs typically. Maybe there will be more this year because we started with 14 and a lot of people have been dropping dogs. So just looking at the number of dogs that most of the teams have, it definitely seems like it's smaller than in past years. And there's only a couple of teams. I think there might only be one team that has all 14 dogs, and there's only a couple teams still at the moment that have 12 or 13 dogs. So I'm just speculating, but that could be part of the reason why he scratched.
Right. And we don't know yet if that 14 dog rule is a major impact. I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that after the race is over. A lot of the mushers will, I'm sure, talk about whether that was a good rule or not. It was highly praised before the race. There wasn't a lot of back talk about it, you know, negativity talked about it going into it. But I do find it interesting that so many teams have so less dogs. And again, just from a little bit of a personal experience, running with 5 dogs is a difficult prospect over many miles. They just don't have the power to pull a heavy sled and, you know, a heavy musher and all that, especially if it's over difficult terrain. And then again, sometimes it's a strategy. I know Dallas Seavey, that's part of his strategy, is he'll come into the later checkpoints of the race and he'll drop a good number of his dogs. And I think he said he likes to finish with about 6 dogs. And he does that for strategy reasons, because taking care of 6 dogs at a checkpoint or even on the line is a heck of a lot easier than taking care of 12. Your chores are automatically cut in half. So it's taking you, you know, maybe an hour and a half to do everything you have to do at a checkpoint coming and going. Now that can do, you can do in 30 minutes or maybe 45 minutes. So it's a big strategy boost. But most teams aren't like that. Most teams still need that power from multiple dogs. And coming in with 5 in harness, that's the bare minimum. And does in harness mean they have to be on the line, Alex, or can a dog or two be in the bag? I don't know exactly what the rule says.
I believe that means that they have to be on the line, but I'm not positive.
Okay.
We'll check that.
All right. Well, that is it for today. Again, I apologize for any bad audio on my end. As I said, I'm sitting here in a parking lot in Wasilla. It's a balmy 42 degrees and raining. So what they call breakup is upon us here in Alaska. And otherwise, Alex, it's always a pleasure. We'll talk again tomorrow, okay?
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. Make sure you tell your friends to listen to our show and hit that subscribe button, and you will get an update on your device as soon as it drops. And this one will probably drop, I don't know, around 7 p.m. Alaska time. So stay tuned, and we'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Goodbye.